Welcome to Wisdom Trek with Gramps. Wisdom is the final frontier in gaining true knowledge. Our mission is to create a legacy of wisdom, to seek out discernment and insights, and to boldly grow where few have chosen to grow before. Hello, my friend. This is Gramps. Thanks for coming along on our journey to increase wisdom and create a living legacy. Today is day 1581 of our trek, and it is Worldview Wednesday. Creating a biblical worldview is essential to have a proper perspective on today's current events. To establish a biblical worldview, you must have a proper understanding of God and His Word. This week we will continue reviewing the book from Dr. Michael S. Heiser titled Supernatural. The book is an abbreviated version of his more comprehensive book, The Unseen Realm. I highly recommend both of these books. Creating a biblical worldview based on how the Old and New Testament connects with God's overall plan for humanity is essential. This book review will help you to understand what the Bible teaches about the unseen world and why it matters. And today's chapter title is Not of This World. In Jesus' well-known prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane, before he was arrested for trial, he said to his followers in John chapter 17, verse 16, "They do not belong to this world any more than I do." Believers were certainly in the world, specifically tasked by God to carry the gospel to every nation, Matthew chapter 28, verses 19 and 20. But they were not of the world. This paradox, being in the world but not of it, is telegraphed to early Christians in several memorable ways. Part of this involves sacred space, holy ground, and God's presence. In chapter 8 of Supernatural, we talked about the concept of sacred space. For Old Testament Israelites, God was utterly other. The space His presence occupied was set apart from all other space. This wasn't a denial of God's omnipresence, that is, in all places at all times. Instead, it was a way of marking the territory on which He chose to meet with His people. That was one of the purposes of having the tabernacle and the temple. The concept of sacred space was not only a rationale for many of the Israel laws and rituals, but it also reinforced the idea of cosmic geography, how the world was divided among the lesser gods and the Most High God, the God of Israel. The notion of sacred space gets brought into the New Testament in a dramatic way. All we need to ask is, where is the presence of God right now? While God is everywhere, He dwells explicitly within each believer. Believe it or not, you are sacred space. Paul very clearly wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 19, "Don't you realize that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, who lives in you and was given to you by God?" The same is true of the ground where believers gather as a group. Within the church at Corinth, Paul told them collectively in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, 16, "Don't you realize that all of you together are the temple of God and the Spirit of God lives in you?" He told the Ephesians believers that they were members of the household of God, a holy temple in the Lord. In Him, you are also built together into a dwelling place for God by the Spirit. The implications are startling. Most of us are familiar with Jesus' statement in Matthew chapter 18, verse 20, "For where two or three are gathered together as my followers, I am among them." But viewed in the context of the Old Testament idea of sacred space, this statement means that wherever believers gather, the spiritual ground they occupy is sanctified amid the powers of darkness. Yahweh's final chosen dwelling place in the Old Testament was Israel, the temple in Jerusalem. Israel became holy ground because that is where God's presence resided. But the holy ground was threatened by the nations that surrounded it and their hostile gods. In the same way, believers today are in a spiritual war. We are now God's temple, the special place where God resides, points of the lights of His presence, and we are scattered throughout the world in bondage to the powers of darkness. That is why some of the New Testament passages may seem like that they're difficult to understand, and one of those is delivered unto Satan. This concept is illustrated well by Paul's view on the sanctity of the local church. Every body of believers was holy ground, which is no place for unrepentant sin. In chapter 8 of Supernatural, we looked at how Israel's camp dealt with sin to preserve its sanctity, its sacred space. We talked about the Day of Atonement in Leviticus chapter 16, where the sins of the nation were richly transferred to the goat, the one for Azazel. Azazel was a demonic entity thought to inhabit the wilderness. The Israelites sent the goat out into the wilderness, carrying their sins away. The act symbolically sent their sins of the people where they belonged into the wilderness, the place of spiritual darkness. Paul has the Corinthians deal with sin in the same way, sending it where it belongs. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 5, Paul wrote to the Corinthians about a man living in sexual immorality who needed to repent. In this verse he commanded, "Then you must throw this man out and hand him over to Satan, so that his sinful nature will be destroyed and he himself will be saved on the day the Lord returns." The rationale is clear. Sin has no place on holy ground. Believers were to remove unrepentant believers from the church. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 9 through 13. To be expelled from the church was to be thrust into the realm of Satan, back out into the world. Paul's hope that the result of the unrepentant man would be his sinful nature would be destroyed and he himself be saved on the day the Lord returns. The reference here isn't to physical death, but death of his fleshly lust ensnaring the man. And this also ties into the concept of baptism as spiritual warfare. Peter's stand on this issue was the same as Paul's. Believers were pitted against the powers of darkness. His warfare thinking was found in one of the stranger passages in the New Testament, and that is 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 14 through 22. Let me read that. "But even if you might suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not be afraid of their intimidation or be disturbed, but set Christ apart as Lord of your hearts, always ready to make a defense to anyone who asks you for an accounting concerning the hope that is in you. But do so with courtesy and respect, having a good conscience, so that in the things at which you are slandered, the ones who malign your good conduct in Christ may be put to shame. For it is better to suffer for doing good, if God wills it, than for doing evil. For Christ also suffered for sins, the just for the unjust, in order that he could bring you to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which also he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, who were formerly disobedient, when the patience of God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was being constructed, in which a few, that is 8 souls, were rescued through water. And also corresponding to this, baptism now saves you, not in the removal of the dirt from the flesh, but an appeal to God for good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who is at the right hand of God, having gone into heaven with the angels and authorities and powers having been subjected to him." I'm sure you've noticed the oddities of this passage. What do the ark, Noah, and the imprisoned spirits have to do with baptism? And does this text say baptism saves us? What Peter is doing here is similar to something Paul does in Romans chapter 5. Paul talked about Jesus in that passage, but with Adam in mind as well. Think of Jesus as, in some ways, the opposite of Adam. That is why Paul says the things like, "As one man's disobedience, Adam's, were many made sinners, so one man's obedience, Jesus, that many will be made righteous," Romans chapter 5, verse 19. Rather than Adam, Peter has Enoch in mind as he writes about Jesus in 1 Peter chapter 3. But for Peter, Enoch and Jesus weren't opposites. Enoch serves as an analogy for the point Peter wants to make about Jesus. You might wonder, what is that point? After all, there are only a handful of verses about Enoch in the Old Testament, in Genesis chapter 5, verses 18 through 24. All we learn in that passage is that he lived before the great flood, and that, walking in close fellowship with God, then one day he disappeared because God took him, Genesis chapter 5, verse 24. Those verses don't really have any connection to what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 3 about Jesus. To understand why something Enoch did reminded Peter of Jesus, we need to understand that Peter read about Enoch in the Jewish books outside of the Old Testament. Specifically, Peter was familiar with the ancient Jewish text that had a lot to say about Enoch, and that book was named, predictably, 1 Enoch. The book is filled with lots of details about what happened at the time of the flood, especially the episodes in Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, where the sons of God, Enoch calls them watchers, produced children, the Nephilim giants, with human women. When both Peter and Jude wrote about the angels who sinned in the days of Noah, in 2 Peter chapter 2 verses 4 and 5 and in Jude verse 6, they were alluding to the ideas in 1 Enoch that are not part of the biblical flood story. The Genesis flood account, for example, never tells us that the divine sons of God were imprisoned in the underworld realm of the dead until the end of the days, but 1 Enoch does. Something that happened to these spirits in prison in the book of 1 Enoch gave Peter insight into Jesus. In the first Enoch story, Enoch had a dream where the imprisoned spirits asked him to intercede with God on their behalf. After all, Enoch walked with God. Who better to ask God to relent and release them? Enoch did intercede but got bad news. God's answer was an emphatic no. Enoch then delivered the answer. He descended to the spirits in prison. He told them that they were still under judgment. Peter used this story as an analogy for Jesus. The point he wanted to get across was that when Jesus died, he descended into the realm of the dead and had a message for the fallen divine beings there. When they saw Jesus enter into the place of the dead, they were likely to think their fellow demons had won and that they would be getting out of jail soon. Instead, Jesus told him that he wouldn't see him for long, that he would rise again. It was all part of God's plan. They hadn't won. They were still under judgment and as doomed as ever. That's why this odd passage ends the way it does in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 22. Now Christ has gone to heaven, seated in the place of honor next to God, and all the angels and authorities and powers accept his authority. Why does Peter connect all this to baptism? In Peter's mind, Jesus' death and resurrection, complete with the announcement to the demonic powers of his victory, was symbolized in baptism. Baptism symbolizes the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, and this can be found in Romans chapter 6, verses 1 through 11. For Peter, baptism corresponds to all this because it says in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 21, "And the water is a picture of baptism, which now saves you, not by removing dirt from your body, but as a response to God from a clean conscience. It is effective because of the resurrection of Jesus Christ." The Greek word apio refers to a pledge one takes. The Greek word for conscience often refers to an ability to tell right from wrong, but that isn't the case here. Knowing the difference between right and wrong doesn't have a specific relationship to the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. The Greek word can also point to making a commitment, and a good commitment, not a foolish one. That is what Peter is getting at in 1 Peter chapter 3. In essence, baptism was a loyalty oath and a message to the demonic powers, as well as to any other people present, and that represents whose side you are on in this spiritual war. Ancient Christians understood this better than we do today. Early church baptismal rites included the renunciation of Satan and his angels because of this passage. So let's look at why all of this matters. First, understand that believers are holy ground, the dwelling place of God's presence, the glory of the Old Testament. So let me ask you the question, do we live like it? Israelites and the believers of Jesus' day felt an ever-present need to be different from unbelievers. The goal wasn't to be deliberately odd, so unbelievers would hope to avoid contact. Israel was to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, Exodus chapter 19, verse 6. Living the way God wanted his children to live led to fruitful, productive, and happy lives. Israelites were to attract people enslaved by enemy gods back to the true God. When our worldview is attuned to God's plan to rescue the people from every nation, making them part of God's family, we are not of this world. Being of this world is to be absorbed by the world's concern and living accordingly. Unbelievers should be able to tell by our speech, behavior, ethics, and attitude toward others that we're not cynical, selfish, or harsh, that our focus is not about getting ahead or on using other people. We should not live to gratify ourselves. We are to be the antithesis of these things. In other words, we are to live as Jesus lived. People wanted to be around him because he wasn't like most everyone else. Second, what we do in our churches should elevate God and Jesus. In biblical times, to visit the tabernacle or temple reinforced the ideas of God's perfection, his otherness, and love for his children. Those things go hand in hand. Why would God, who needs nothing and is superior to everything, want a human family? Why would God bother creating a new family after casting aside the nations at Babel, consigning them to other gods? Why not just walk away? And the answer is, because he loves us. It's because we know God could have done something else, but didn't, that his love takes on real meaning. When the church talks only about the love of God without pointing out the irony of that love when placed against God's other character traits, believers will take that love for granted. It might sound cheap, for instance, to the people who are unaware of God's holiness. The third implication of what we've discussed in this chapter is that the powers of darkness know whose side we are on by our behavior. They are not stupid. They see our loyalty to God, and they see us act on our decisions to follow Jesus through things like baptism and the resistance to sin. But they also see us when we act disloyally to God, and they understand what vulnerability that introduces into our lives. Whether or not we believe it, we are being watched by both sides of the spiritual war. These truths are certainly easier to understand than to live out. Though we are redeemed, we are fallen. To live these truths, we need our minds and hearts turned to why we are here, living as foreigners in our own world. Like Jesus, we are not of this world. In it, but not of it. The contrast of our status will become even sharper once we get a handle on just what it means to be children of God. And that will finish our study for this week's Worldview Wednesday. Join us again next week as we continue with the next chapter in Supernatural in our quest to build our biblical worldview. Tomorrow we will ponder another bit of wisdom from Gramps, so encourage your friends and family to join us and to come along with us tomorrow for another day of Wisdom Trek, Creating a Legacy. If you'd like to listen to any of the past 1,580 treks or read the Wisdom Journals, they are all available at wisdom-trek.com. And I encourage you to subscribe to Wisdom Trek on your favorite podcast player so that each day's trek will be downloaded to you automatically. And thank you so much for allowing me to be your guide, your mentor, but most importantly, I am your friend as I serve you through the Wisdom Trek podcast and journal each day. And as we take this trek of life, together, let us always live abundantly, love unconditionally, listen intentionally, learn continuously, lend to others generously, lead with integrity, and leave a living legacy each day. I am Guthrie Chamberlain, reminding you to keep moving forward. Enjoy your journey and create a great day every day. See you tomorrow for more bits of wisdom.